you're running a business right now, you're playing a game where the rules keep changing. Trade tensions, economic uncertainty, culture wars, the world is rapidly changing around us. And companies, especially independent and local businesses, are having to adapt faster than ever. That's why Mission Critical is evolving. We're diving deep with the founders, CEOs, and entrepreneurs who are navigating this chaos in real time. The ones making the tough calls, pushing through unpredictability, and proving that resilience isn't just a buzzword, it's a survival skill. How do you scale in an economy that feels like it's on shaky ground? What happens when US policy shifts send shockwaves through Canadian industries? And in a world where diversity, healthcare, and economic resilience are becoming battlegrounds, how do businesses double down instead of backing down? These are the real conversations that matter to business leaders right now. I'm Lance Chung, and this is Mission Critical. Let's get into it. Hello, Richard. Good morning, or I guess good morning from Toronto, but good afternoon from London on your end.
Yeah, correct. Good morning, Lance. I've been really looking forward to this. I'm always happy to talk to people who are interested in our industry. So thanks for your time.
Yeah, I'm super excited for our chat. And I also am just very excited about your perspective on some of the things that we're going to talk about, especially just kind of the overall dialogue and conversation when it comes to wellness, well-being. I mean, this is something that has completely integrated into our culture, whether it's through fitness, whether it's through the things that we eat or put on our body, all these different things. So I think that's a really interesting conversation that we're having right now. Before we kind of get into it, I want to talk about the company that you're leading, Ride. You know, you've led some of the world's most iconic CPG brands, and now you're running Ride. Can you take us through what that journey has been like and what drew you to Ride? And also, like, ultimately, what are you building there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's been a really exciting journey. As you said, I've worked on some of Australia's most iconic brands early in my career, and preceding joining BAT Group, I also worked on what I still believe is the most exciting ice cream brand, Haagen-Dazs. So I've had some really amazing experiences working on some established businesses, some turnaround stories, some relaunching of brands. I think what's really exciting about what we're building here with the Ride brand is we get the power of a big corporate behind us, but we're doing it from a very small scale. And that's the first experience of that I've had in my career. From that, it means, well, it's not just about building the brand, but it's about building the organization around it. So how do you operate in sort of a big corporate world, but at the same time try to be fleet of foot, flexible enough to operate against small brands? And that's been an exciting, it's been a learning curve for me around how to build the organization, but equally around sort of almost relearning marketing again. It's a bit of a, it's almost in some ways going back to my roots. So how do you really start from the real core, the real sort of embryo, and then start to establish some principles on how do you scale the thing? And that's kind of where we're at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. While I was preparing for our chat, I was reading through your bio, and at one point it mentions, quote, team awesomeness making. And I feel like that's a really unique way to describe leadership, and also gives me a kind of a perspective on the culture of the business as well. What is that, you know, what does team awesomeness making look like in practice?
Yeah, I think I've had some really good leaders and mentors in my career that have taught me that ultimately culture and how you give people space to operate, it's fundamentally not just important in terms of motivation levels of an organization, but also in getting the best work out the door. So when I talk about trying to create a culture of awesomeness, for me, that's about giving people clear direction, but at the same time, giving them the space to actually go off and build things themselves. In the marketing world, in the startup world, it's really important that you can turn your entire organization into builders, creators, because you never have enough resources to deliver what you want to. And if you try to tightly control things, it doesn't work. So I'm a firm believer in growth mindset, giving people a clear problem to solve, but at the same time, giving them the flexibility and the empowerment to go off and solve those problems how they think is best. No matter how smart you are, and I'm I'm kind of, I'd call myself mediocre smart. You're always going to be smarter by allowing people to think for themselves and build the way they think is best. And that's for me, that's the fundamental thing that I'm trying to build here, is a kind of a culture of growth mindset.
Yeah. And also, I think what I've learned, and from a lot of the interviews that we've had and just the people that we have been able to, you know, chat with, is, you know, it's so important also to surround yourself with people who are smarter than you as well, because you shouldn't have to be the smartest at everything, or nor can you always be. And that's why you build a great team, because they're able to be experts on their kind of given area of expertise.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's another piece also that, and I tend to hire equal for aptitude and for attitude. You've also got to accept that people need to learn as they go too. And I think if you have an obsession with knowing everything all the time, especially from the top of the organization or the people that quote unquote make decisions, then you don't allow the organization to actually learn as you go. And it's certainly in our space. I mean, we talk about well-being, wellness. It's evolving so fast. And so you need to be able to allow the organization to move with it. Otherwise, you're already in the dust before you start.
Yeah, exactly. On that note, you know, Ride is positioned really kind of as an antidote to kind of this pressure-filled wellness industry. And, you know, when we talk about quote-unquote wellness and well-being, those terms have really become catch-all phrases, especially these days, where it's really hard to define exactly what that means, because it's been used so much. And, you know, in some instances they inspire, in other instances they alienate. When do you think these terms are used well, and conversely, when do you think that they become unhelpful in the way that that language is being used?
I think ultimately what we've learned is everyone has their own aspiration for them, their personal lives, their own health, their own understanding of what's right for them in terms of making themselves feel well. When it becomes prescriptive, or when it becomes competitive, by which I mean trying to put up an ideal where people ultimately can't ever achieve it, I think that's when it's really negative. I do think there is a side of the wellness industry which has become almost like the industry of diet in the past, whereby people are, the marketing tools and the marketing methods used are ultimately trying to stress people out to consume products. And I think what we've seen in culture is we don't want to be part of that. We actually want to have a bit of fun with it. We all know that to be well, ultimately, it's about giving yourself space for your own mental health. It's to have the right eating habits. It's to do the exercise, to spend the time socializing in a way that keeps you connected to community. Brands and products can't solve those things for you. That's 80 to 90% yourself. And we're comfortable with that. And we don't want to prescribe or motivate people to think differently against that. Actually, what we want to say is, look, we all kind of fundamentally know what's good for us. There are some times in an imperfect world that it's great to have something that can help you over a hump, that can give you a nudge. Nothing more, nothing less. And we sort of commit with the brand Ride, that's where we want to play. We're not saving the world, but we will help you in a defined period get over some sort of daily problems. And that's where we want to focus on. And certainly the other side of the wellness industry, which frustrates us, is just the sea of products that exist that do not have any scientific backing to them. No testing is done, no quality controls on the ingredients. And certainly it can operate at a big brand, even at a small brand level, people flout the rules around regulations as tight as they are in Canada, and really try to push messages that are not able to be backed up. And we certainly don't want to be part of that. And I think that's about knowing your size. For us, is we're a small help. And that is important for us. We want to also operate in a very defined space that we can credibly back up. And we spend the money and the time on making sure that our products do work. And that's important to us.
Yeah. I guess building on that, you know, there's often, I think right now, and as you kind of alluded to, you know, the culture of wellness in the past, but especially now with in the social media era and in this era of like instant gratification, there is kind of a stigma around like quick fixes around health. How do you reframe what Ride offers as something that is empowering rather than like a shortcut or something, you know?
And look, it's a challenge. I think ultimately people can make up their own mind. Our products are not super expensive, but they're not cheap either. We spend a fair bit of time one-on-one, either through means of digital or through partners that we use, sort of creators or influencers, or more importantly for us when we do our activation and sampling, explaining exactly what our products do, not over promising, but explaining the science that goes into them and explaining where people can use them. We don't prescribe using our products regularly in terms of, you know, having multiple ride shots in a day, because if someone's got some issues with focus or with their energy levels, there's something bigger that's going on there. But certainly if you've had a big night the night before, or you've come off a plane and you're feeling a little bit cloudy, our products hit that point. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, we use plasters to cover grazes. They can heal themselves. We take Panadol or paracetamol when we're trying to deal with a headache. And most of the time, you're really just looking at a quick fix. The industry exists and the behavior exists. And I think what's important for us is we explain that it works, but we also don't overpromise that this is going to fix any fundamental health issues. Because again, that's back to where I started, is that's something more fundamental, and that's individual and should be dealt with in the more traditional way, which is just looking after yourself, really.
Yeah, and building on that, you know, so today for a busy kind of modern professional or just a person that's on the go, which I feel like is mostly everyone these days.
Yeah, absolutely.
What does real world kind of like well-being look like to you? How do you define that for these individuals?
Caveat that I'm not a doctor or a nutritionist or a health professional in any form, but if I look at myself, because I can talk on my own opinion, I think what's been important to me certainly is I'm no longer a 20-year-old or even a 30-year-old, is looking at things like how often and how much do I sleep properly? That's really important to me. Also things like, am I getting the right level of exercise or just spending the time outside? And how's my nutrition look? And these are the fundamentals in people's daily life and should always start there. I think also myself, I still also use products that help augment my well-being at certain moments. I find that magnesium works for me really well in aiding my sleep. That's my own personal view. And there is some science to back that up, as well as helping my focus levels. And I use our products quite regularly, actually. A relaxed product. Anytime I need to go present to the people that fund us, I tend to have a couple of relaxed shots. My own personal view is that the L-teanine and the stack that we put into that product certainly helps keep me on the level during a 1.5 hour pitch to get funding. So I think that's where we play. Again, back to the point, we're not here to solve fundamental issues, but you know, we use coffee in the morning to kind of give us a little bit of levity and anti-fatigue. We use tea, whether or not we realize it, in the afternoon, often just to kind of chill us out. And there's L-teanine in tea. So for those moments, Ride fits in nicely. And we also spend the time to make sure that whatever we put into our products has a synergistic effect. So it's not just the one particular active ingredient, but it's how you layer those things and what's the scientific evidence to prove that putting certain combinations of things together at certain levels can have a superior effect than just having a sort of the botanical compound or similar.
Yeah, yeah. So Ride, you know, it focuses on energy, focus, and relaxation, the three moods that most people seem to cycle through daily or multiple times in a given day, depending what's on your schedule. What have you learned about kind of the rhythms and the pacing of modern life and modern kind of professionals and people on the go from building this brand? Like, why did you focus on those? Have you guys focused on these three things as a brand?
Yeah, I mean, you call it out. I mean, it's not rocket science. We learned that there are some, we talk about our segment as natural rhythm, which is less about how natural your products are, but it's more around humans, especially professionals and people who are reaching an age where they're or they're more deeply involved in the category, tend to do more research. And they tend to start understanding that you're not looking for a one size fits all. Sometimes you genuinely need something that's going to help you with fatigue. Sometimes you're going to need something that's less around your energy levels and it's going to be more around your focus, because I have a specific task to do that requires concentration. And sometimes I'm just trying to deal with stresses. Human beings increasingly, and we're seeing that very much in Canada, have become more pointed around what they're looking for. It's not about just reaching for a coffee or an energy drink. It's certainly people are looking to try to modulate depending on exactly how they feel at that moment. And I'm not sure if that's the industry driving that or it's consumers driving that, but certainly in Canada also, I mean, even with the cannabis industry, I think people are much more aware of needs around certain need states and what they're looking for within mood management than they ever have been before. And I think that's really exciting. What we're doing is not fundamentally new in the wellness industry. We're just getting better at it. A lot of this stuff, whether it be, Ayurveda or, Asian medicine, so traditional Chinese medicine, this stuff's existed for a long time. I think what we're able to do now is package it up in a way that's perhaps more accessible and ideally from our point of view, also more scientifically backed. So it delivers a better punch than perhaps the more traditional methods.
Yeah, yeah. Have you had any feedback from, your consumers and your audience about, further evolving the existing product set or introducing kind of new focuses?
Yeah, absolutely. I think look, there is a lot of different spaces. We've looked at clearly within the exercise industry or the fitness industry, there's a role to play there. We want to make sure we enter in the right way. So what is the right sort of everyday functional shot, not necessarily targeted towards professionals? We've looked at that and we've actually launched one in Australia as a test. And the other space is sleep. Most people will look at their sleep patterns and say they're not optimal. Again, most of the time you can deal with that quite easily. You should just switch off your phone or put it away and then have a cup of tea, read a book, and you'll go to sleep, right? It's not always that easy, but certainly sleep's another one that we're looking at. And again, we're testing a sleep shot in Australia. So those would be the next two. But we'll go with where our consumers see opportunities for us. There is a huge range of different needs that are emerging. One thing, and also lots of new functional ingredients, if you will. One thing that's important to us is, one, the need's big enough. But the second thing is the science backs the ingredients. So there's a lot of ingredients that have kind of emergent science, but don't necessarily have enough credible science for us to put into a liquid, into a bottle. We will not enter in anything that we can't back up with a genuine claim.
Yeah, yeah. So speaking on that. Yeah, yeah, for sure. Just speaking to that, we've talked about science, and I think it is so important, especially when we're talking about the context of wellness and well-being, that things are differentiated by having actual evidence-based kind of research and backing behind it. Can you unpack a little bit more about what exactly the science is behind the three products and how it works across the range?
Yes, absolutely. So first I'd say is, out of all the markets in which we operate, Canada is by far the most stringent, both from a consumer lens, but also from a regulator lens. And I think that's exciting, actually. I think whilst as a brand owner, it's frustrating because you've got to jump through a few hoops. It's actually really good because over time, between society, the Canadian society, and also the regulator, it should mean that the industry is relatively clean, which is great. That's good news. And that's what we want for ourselves, because we have a level playing field, but also for the consumer, I think it's important. So that's really good about Canada. In terms of what we do ourselves, we go through a number of steps. First of all, we look at, as I said before, what need states we think are big and growing. What exactly about the need state may fit in this case, a particular format, so shots. Then we will go through what are the lists of actives that have really good, credible science behind them. So we know at what level, what kind of source or what kind of type it'll deliver a certain effect based on the need state we're looking for. And then we'll also look at whether or not combining certain ingredients will have a synergistic effect. So by combining things like caffeine and L-theanine, you get a different effect than just say caffeine with B vitamins alone, things like that. So we'll do a bit of work there. And the way we do that is actually we go through huge amounts of scientific dossiers, so other people's basically scientific studies, government, independent organizations, anything that's been published, and we look for the hot spots. That's the first sort of scientific stage for us. Then what we'll do is we'll build our recipe and we will test it. And it changes depending on the function of the product, but we will effectively put it through some level of a human effect study where we're not trying to test for perception from a consumer. We're actually trying to test for actual delivery. So do we see a change in behavior? Some of our studies will include things like getting consumers to do certain things to understand whether or not, for example, under the focus shot, their cognition is better than placebo when we're using our product. So we design certain tests. And when we do that, we tend to work with third parties at universities, scientific experts, both at the design phase around the dossiers and putting ingredients together, but also around designing the human effects studies. We're not the first people to do this, so it's important to use the industries that understand it best and then adapt it accordingly. That's going to be right for the particular thing we're testing. So it's kind of those sorts of stages: understanding the need state, doing the research around available science, and then testing your own products, which is right for the individual product. But for us, that investment's worthwhile because one, we can back up our claims; two, we can talk to the regulator and say yes, we know what we're doing; and then three, we feel confident when we're talking to a consumer that the product actually works, and that's fundamentally important to us.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Now, I also, you know, a lot of people might hear energized shots and conflate that with an energy drink, which are two very different things. How do you differentiate Ride from that category? Because that's a whole other type of category as well.
Yeah, and I tend to talk about when you're talking about functional drinks, it's called functional drinks, you kind of have a triangle. You've got what does the brand stand for, what's the role of the function, and how much does taste or refreshment play a role? What's important for us is making sure that the experience around the shot is really around a concentrated delivery, both in the experience, but also ideally when you concentrate the things, you're getting a shorter term effect. It also means that we're offering something that doesn't necessarily lead you to go to the toilet, which, believe it or not, is actually something a lot of people talk about, especially people who are out at night and in the nightclub, and it's quite difficult to go to the toilet, or gamers as well have talked to us a lot about, well, this thing's great because rather than drinking a massive can of whatever, I can drink it and I can stay seated for the next 2 hours. I'm not going to need to go to the toilet. So that's part of the format delivery. Also, the stack that we've developed is unique to us. And so we try to include a mixture of vitamins plus caffeine at the right level, which will give you a sort of more than just a straight caffeination effect. The other thing that's important to us is just making sure we hit the right caffeine load, that it makes you feel less tired, but at the same time doesn't give you jitters, which is really important to us as well. Some of the larger formats lead consumers to, or can edge over to, a bit of a caffeine overload. And then just generally about our range, we try to keep the thing low-cal. We don't include sugar. We've made the call that an artificial sweetener, a safe one, is the right approach for our consumers, because what's more important is something that is not going to affect your teeth or not going to add to your calorie intake for the day, and really just focuses purely on the function, which was a choice. Other brands have gone down the more natural sugars route. We've decided not to do it based on what consumers have told us.
Sure. Yeah, that makes total sense. I also want to kind of talk about your own career path and entrepreneurial kind of perspective too, because that all kind of influences the work that you're doing there. You know, having operated at, you know, both global kind of corporations and brands and companies that have more of a startup mentality, how would you compare the two types of leadership environments? And like, what's something that has been transferable and what's also just like completely different and doesn't transfer over?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I actually think the difference between a startup and a corporate is not that great. I think we like to talk about it being great. I think the fact is that impact how you operate or create tensions for how you operate based on, tend to be based on one, what kind of culture you want to create, I'll talk about that, or how complex you've organized yourselves. We are a startup, we're quite a large startup for our scale, but that's because we're backed by a corporate. But what we've tried to avoid is a culture whereby we're created lots of layers, and we've actually avoid creating artificial distinctions between things like global and local. A lot of these, a lot of corporates naturally by design like to see things sort of neat on an organogram, and that leads to a lot of siloing. And I think that's one of the first points that drives things like over-governance, over-process. But you don't need to do that. We are surrounded by big corporate governance, but we don't operate that way. We have articulated the way we want to operate, which is more accountability-driven culture, growth mindset-driven culture, rather than what your title says and where you sit in the organization. That completely defines where you operate. So we've tried to create a sort of a flatter and more integrated structure to the extent that a global brand team are really an extension from our local team, and they work together. It's not a handover effect. We're all around playing the game, same game together. I'm being really passionate about that because I've been in global teams that have been at arm's reach from the market. And that's, for any organization, that's not smart. But certainly for us at our scale, we're still learning and evolving. Integration is really important. The other thing is around culture, just back to this thing. I've got a real bugbear with process. I think organizations love process. They love flowcharts. They love races. But what sports team operates with a process or a racy, right? That's not how they operate. They're clear on the game they're all playing, and they're clear on the position they play. They've got roles, and they're also clear on how things can move with each other. And I've been trying to build that in our organization. So trying to keep people focused on what are the big principles of things we need to deliver? Let's try to do less. At the same time, how do we work together on building things together and run? It's kind of, I guess it's adopted from the kind of the tech industry, but how do you run sort of mini scrum teams or mini project teams on certain deliverables, certain principles we're trying to execute? So I'll give you a simple example. So one of our biggest learnings and growth areas is how do we show up in store? And that's been something we've needed to iterate. Where in store? What's the right point of sale? What's the right messaging? How do we communicate that to the retailer? How do we make sure that integrates with our broader marketing? If we just had someone focused on point of sale or trade worrying about how they put it in the market, we wouldn't be optimizing it. But because we've got effectively about four or five people who have other jobs working on this, we've been able to develop kind of a perfect store concept, which now we can use across all markets. And it continues to evolve because you've got the same people working on it. So being focused on your big value ideas, your big value propositions, and getting people to work around them like a team, rather than worrying about what's my name and what's my title and where do I sit in the organization, it creates much more of an integrated flow. So for me, it's those sorts of things. Keeping it flat, keeping people focused on what their sort of bigger deliverable is, and then motivating people to take a bit of ownership as a group and just run with it. And that's the other thing, as a kind of a leadership structure, we focus more on what's your diagnosis and what's kind of your use case, or what are you hoping to achieve? Tell me about your KPIs, and then come back to us when you have a discussion on we need to change something, or we need more resource, or we'd like a pivot. But not getting into nitty gritty of, okay, what's it doing this week? What's it doing this week? And which is tends to be how corporates operate, but it slows them down. We definitely don't operate that way.
Sure. And it also sounds like from what you're saying too, bringing people together at the table that have a diversity of perspectives to tackle a problem versus, you know, tackling a problem by function of someone's, you know, quote unquote role too.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We get ideas from everywhere. I mean, we've had a head of operations come up with distribution ideas, which sort of is a bit of a fit, but actually going out and to find distribution partners is not normally where you'd put that kind of job. We've had the legal team get involved in how do we define better claims, which end up with better marketing, because they're obviously the ones dealing with the regulatory risk, right? So when you empower people to kind of come around and try to solve things against a bigger agenda, you get much more out of the organization, because otherwise you end up with an ops director that just waits for the contract for this new distributor so they can flow product through, or a legal counsel that's just waiting for something to review, right? It's mm-hmm. it's a very different way of operating. How do we get everyone on an agenda to solve for something rather than, this is my job, this is my box, I'll stamp it and move on, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, building on that, what would you say is kind of the biggest takeaway for yourself, or the biggest lesson you've learned about cultivating like internal culture and getting buy-in from people? And as you said, like ownership of, you know, someone's role. What's the biggest kind of takeaway that you've learned from that?
Okay, there are two things for me. One, transparency in context setting is really important. When you're a small business, things are constantly evolving and you need to make pivots. When you are making a pivot, you need to make sure everyone understands why and what exactly the pivot is, because otherwise the organization is marching one direction and there may be some peel off and then you've got a kind of a schism. So that transparency and context setting is really important. It's also giving the broader organization empathy for what exactly is going on. And I think that kind of empathy and understanding helps people get motivated when you need to do something else. That's one. The second thing is, it's probably more micro, but I think it's really important. I tend to try to model a behavior whereby I don't let people off the hook with asking for a decision to be made for them. And I tend to try to get my leadership team to do the same thing. So what I mean by that is, if someone's coming in with a proposal on something, I don't want the usual 1, 2, 3, we can take A, B, or C, what do you think, boss stuff. It's more, do the diagnosis, come up with your proposal and back what you think is right and pitch it to us. It's not meant to drive a sort of a sense of fear into the organization. It's more to, back to that point of accountability and empowerment. That person is going to be a subject matter expert. If they've done their work properly, they're going to know better than us. They need to be able to put themselves out there and say, this is what I think. As a result, it also gives them greater accountability for the next stage, which is to roll forward with it. I think that's a big differentiator from us and some other corporates that I've worked in. It's trying to model the right behavior, is getting people to take the empowerment by forcing them to a situation where you're actually saying, well, we're waiting for you to tell us. We're not going to give you our opinion. Yeah. And it sounds like a small thing, but actually it takes quite a long time to build, especially when you're drawing from a lot of corporates where people are used to doing, we can do A, B, C, these are pros and cons, and there it is, boss. What do you think? No, that's too simple. Yeah. So we've been working on that one. I think that's really important.
Yeah. Yeah. I just wanted to also circle back on something you talked about in terms of growing the teams outside of like headquarters, we'll say. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's growth that and expansion, you know, in the US, Canada, yeah. Australia. How do you think about adapting the brand to different cultural interpretations of wellness and well-being? Like, how do you see, one, where do you see the differences? And two, how do you adapt that messaging if you do?
By and large, we try not to adapt. At a sort of a basic premise around what the brand stands for, how it looks and feels, we try not to adapt. The core of what the brand says. That said, once you get to a local level, the kind of context you're operating in is different. So Canadians have, for example, have a much higher interest in the ingredients and the science behind the products than, say, the American audience will. They still have an interest, but it's not as important. And you, when you become overly obsessed with science in the US, you're narrowing up your focus to a really subset where, generally speaking, Canadians have a much greater appetite for this kind of information. So you need to make some adjustments in your model, but your model should be flexible enough that it's really about, well, we're dialing one up or one down a little bit.
Sure, like and your so levers.
Your levers. Yeah, you're not breaking the fundamentals, but what you're saying is actually for this market, this is a little bit more important, so we're going to go a bit harder. And using Canada as an example, we've recognized that we haven't done a good enough job on mass explaining the science that goes behind the brand, and you'll see more of that in Canada over the next 2 years. And we will pivot that across all the touch points, because that's so important to the Canadian consumer. Whereas in the US, there's still an opportunity to go a little bit harder at the sort of the broader wellbeing culture and have a bit of fun with it, because specifically in the US, wellbeing culture is so extreme. There's a lot of content that can be generated out of it, which Where in Canada, I think it's a little bit more sensible in Canada than it is in the US with some of the behaviors that go on.
Yes. Yeah, a few differences sometimes, especially these days. What do you think success looks like for Ride over the next 5 years here in Canada, but then also just largely as a brand in general?
It's a question I get asked a lot, and it's usually tied to how much money we get. But look, you can never know how fast a brand scales. It's a tough one. So I don't want to put a picture of success in terms of, let's say, revenue or scale.
Yeah.
I think for us, it's almost like I talked to the team about this. I say a runner doesn't run faster. A sprinter doesn't run faster by saying they're going to run faster. They get into the different elements that improves their technique, their fitness, their power, their start, their finish. And these are the kinds of things I try to get the organization to focus on. So what great looks like for me is we've had now kind of 18 months of learning in Canada, a little bit more if we can in Australia, and a bit, and now across markets, including the US. How do we take what we've learned, package it up to a few different things, and just get better at doing that repetitively? It's that consistency piece, because we've been in a sort of an exploratory phase. What about we say this, or what about we look like this, or we turn up here, or we launch this range or this channel? So now we're at a point where we've got enough learning that we've really got to consolidate and just execute with discipline better. I think if we do that, the scale will come naturally. The opportunity for our format and the broader wellbeing industry in all three markets is huge. Obviously, scale different, population's different, but it's big. And for me, so I think that'll come naturally if we focus on those right things. Because I think an obsession over top line is dangerous. It leads to dumb behaviors. What I would rather the organization said, at least we did all the things right, and whatever the number that spits out, we'll spit out. And it's not always in your control. That said, I'm pretty confident we're going to scale quite fast in Canada. Because we've got a lot of the right ingredients there. We've got an absolute killer team. They're hugely motivated. We're seeing a great response from consumers. And now it's, as I said, it's about the discipline, consistency, and it'll naturally happen.
Yeah, it's like you're training for something. But instead of an athlete, it's the company and just that sense of discipline and consistency for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, the wellness industry has gone through so many different waves, from like fitness to diets, meditation apps, supplements. From someone, you know, as someone who has a really great bird's eye view and an industry perspective on the industry, where do you think the next kind of wave is headed, or where do you see things shifting towards in terms of that overall dialogue?
Yeah, and it's a great question, because we've got a lot of catalysts at the moment. Obviously got this whole GLP-1 industry around this kind of weight loss injections.
Yeah.
That's going to dramatic, and the penetration of that, I haven't looked at the latest data in Canada, but if I look at what's happening in, let's say, the UK or the US, the penetration's higher than most people realize. That fundamentally changes the way people look at their diet, because they're having to actually cope with some side effects of using some of these products. And it drives things like understanding your macros better, understanding kind of hydration levels, some of your vitamins and minerals. So certainly that'll drive a bit of a change. Will it fundamentally move things on? No, but it may create much more sophistication and need for what people are using products, or supplements or otherwise. So that's one. The other one, we're seeing this constant acceleration, and it's been going on for so long, but it continues, this protein acceleration. And I think that's gone through a few ways. It's gone through the early adopters, let's call them weightlifters, bodybuilders, that kind of thing, athletes, to now, then the next stage was on, okay, people that broadened out. It went from professionals to pseudo-professionals to a lot of people are interested in their health, and macros and protein's a big one. To now everyone understands that protein has a role to play as a macro, that you need to, it's an insatiable need to have enough protein. And there is a little bit of a analog here around the previous weight loss industry, where everyone is being told, it's back to these pressures, how much protein they need to have each day. It drives a bit of protein anxiety. So I feel like that's the next day. And I've got it myself, right? I know it's an absolute falsehood, but at the same time, I still track how much protein I have each day.
Same, yeah.
Because it gets embedded, right? It gets embedded.
Yeah.
It creates this little anxiety loop in your head. So protein's the other one. And then I think increasingly, especially in Canada, there's a huge vein of exploration around actives in general. There's always someone looking for that new active, be it lion's mane, reishi mushrooms, or other mushrooms in Canada, because there's a whole bunch of exploration going on in Canada. And I think there are a bunch of people who are constantly looking for the next big quick fix. And some of those are coming through. And I think a lot of those are tied to mind. So I do think the mind fitness or mental fitness and mental performance hasn't really kicked yet. I think we're just starting to come into that wave.
And then like the last optimizing.
One, yeah, it's optimizing how you operate, because ultimately, and especially if you think about the backdrop of AI, I think anxiety around your mental performance is only going to increase. And then the last one, which is just starting to come in, is longevity. And I don't know what to make of that yet, but clearly there's a thin edge of the wedge where people are starting to prepare for how do I live longer, but more importantly, how do I live at peak for longer? That's another one that's coming in. So it's an exciting place to be in, because the category has been growing really, really fast for the last 10 years, and it feels like it's just going to accelerate.
Yeah, it does truly feel like that. The conversation and just kind of like the movements and the communities and it seems like there's always something happening and something moving, and the pace is quick. Now, I feel like it's the hot the saunas and the cold plunges. Like, that is a huge thing. That's not necessarily like an active or anything, but is this whole culture and ladders into this well-being conversation as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, the whole hot and cold therapy stuff plays both to mental fitness, but also dealing with things like longevity. There's a whole belief around that. I'm not close enough to the science. It's out of our sphere, but certainly the consumer interest in it's huge. You struggle to find any sort of fitness influencer not dumping themselves in an ice bath these days. I've done it once. I don't know if you have, Lance. Have you done it?
Because my body is primed for that. I don't know if that one's my thing. I do love a sauna, but the cold plunge, especially at like 2 degrees or whatever, they are 2 degrees Celsius. That's not for me. I think that's one I'll probably pass on.
Highly recommend passing. I did it for 10 seconds and that was it.
Not everything has to be for everyone too, right?
Absolutely.
Kind of just a parting question here. If you could kind of leave our audience and listeners with a piece of advice on, because a lot of our audience are, they're entrepreneurs, they have their own businesses, or they're decision makers in their kind of respective companies, organizations, they're builders. If you could leave listeners with kind of one piece of advice on building something with purpose, what would that be for you?
I'll misquote Nate Bargatze, who's one of my favorite comedians. If I could leave people with one advice that at least I've lived by for my adulthood, is be a creator. Be one of the people who builds things. You can go through your entire life just being part of someone else's puzzle. Very easily. And the next day you wake up and you're in your 50s and your 60s and you've missed an opportunity to experience what it's like to create something. And for me, that's always been important. Every single step in my career, and it's become more decided as I've gone through my career, I've taken side steps, which may not have been moves that are natural in terms of career progression, salary progression, whatever, but I've focused on building things, and I have to say it keeps me motivated every day. That is my core purpose, is to build and create.
Yeah, I love that. I've loved our chat, and I would love to finish it off with just a quick rapid fire, if that's something you're down for.
Let's do it.
Okay. First thing you do when you need to recharge?
Have a beer.
Yes. Okay. Book or podcast that's helped shape how you think about leadership?
Jim Collins, From Good to Great book.
Okay. Is there a product outside of Ride that you can't live without?
Tony's Chocolate Oni.
Oh, yes. Very good. What's a wellness trend that you think is overhyped?
Oxygen bars.
Very good. What's a wellness ritual that you actually believe in?
Taking an early morning walk.
If you weren't in your position right now, what kind of job or what would you be building?
I'd be probably doing the same thing, but for myself.
Can you think of the last bold idea that you said yes to?
Moving to Hong Kong with a newborn baby.
Okay. Yep. Yeah. Fair enough. What's the last bold thing that you can remember that you said no to?
I didn't think I ever have.
Do you have a go-to productivity hack when you need to get things done?
Talking to people I can vent to, I find. People I trust.
Now, as someone that is leading a company and I imagine very, very busy, what's the best airport that you've traveled through?
Singapore. Changi Airport, definitely.
Is there a brand outside of your own that you really admire for what they're doing in their respective category and how they're building community?
I'd say increasingly Heinz, based on the work they've been doing lately, especially on the innovation front, targeting specific subcultures, which is cool, and food types. I think they're in for a rebirth.
Nice, nice. Last question. What's the ride shot that you're reaching for most often?
Focus. Definitely focus. Always need more focus.
Yeah, tell me about it. Thank you so much, Richard, for the chat. This has been, it's just been really interesting learning about the company, the kind of your perspective on the industry, and it's just really kind of exciting to see how you and your team are cultivating and building the brand. It's really cool to see.
Thanks, Lance. I appreciate coming on. Thank you so much.
That's a wrap on this episode of Mission Critical. If today's conversation gave you something to think about, do me a favor. Subscribe, leave a review, and share it with someone who needs to hear it. Big ideas are meant to be shared, and the best insights only matter if they're put into action. Until next time, stay sharp, stay curious, and go and make something happen. I'm Lance Chung, and this is Mission Critical.